Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Well, St. Louis has a brand new circuit attorney, Kim Gardner. She is the first new face in that job this century. For 16 years, Jennifer Joyce has held the position. She surprised a great many of her supporters and some critics when she's decided not only to leave the office, but to leave public life. Rather than pursue criminal justice, she's decided to chase the sun. She and her husband will drive their RV to wherever warm weather takes them. That may include to a mountain or two she wants to climb. We're happy to have Jennifer Joyce with us in studio to talk about her 16 years as the city's top prosecutor before she hits the road. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What's with this mountain climbing business? Haven't you climbed enough mountains over the last 16 years?
Well, I'm talking literal mountains now, figurative mountains. Yeah. So, yeah, one of my goals is to kind of get myself into a level of physical shape that I don't think you can when you have a desk job. So that's important to both my husband and I. So.
You know, I said before we went on the air, I don't think I've ever seen you look as relaxed, and you've only been out of the job for a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, I'm wearing jeans today. Normally when I come here, I'm in business attire. So this is my business attire now.
Okay. Well, you look great.
Thank you.
And we wish you the very best in the weeks and months and years ahead. Let's talk a little bit about the past, though, if we can.
Of course.
I'm sure you've spent some time looking back and reflecting as you've approached the end of your time in the prosecutor's office.
Yes.
What systemically would you like to see changed?
In the office the city in general?
Well, basically in the office as it applies to the justice system.
I would like to see sufficient resources be given to prosecutors' offices and public defenders' offices. I think the attorneys that handle those cases should be paid on a par with the attorneys who are handling the private sector law practice. Mm-hmm. If you help people fight over money, that's great. And you get paid under our system at a markedly higher rate than the people who are fighting the law and order battles, the battles for justice every mm-hmm. day. And I think that we can have more career prosecutors if we invest in having those public servants be paid appropriately. And I'm imagining the public defenders would say the same.
In terms of working with the courts and with the system itself, in terms of I'm having trouble wording this the way I really want to. I am thinking about changes, revision, reform, that sort of thing. That's where I want to take
okay.
this.
Okay. Well, you know what? I think that as a whole, we need to be less about blaming other agencies and other parts of government for the problems that we see in terms of public safety and the levels of crime and what's happening in our city. I'd like to see us less interested in blaming and more in everybody thinking about what can they do? Mm. What can they do that's different? Not be afraid to try new things, to break new ground. I'm kind of notorious in my office for changing things a lot. I changed things when I first came in 16 years ago, and I did probably 3 or 4 total reorganizations after that. Mm-hmm. Not because I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, but because I think it's important to always be looking for a way to improve and elevate what you're doing and to get best practices. So my office was very used to me coming in and saying, I've just learned about this. I've studied it. They're doing it in whatever city, and I think we should try it. I think that's a great attitude to have. I would like to see that attitude in the courts and also, by and large, in the police department as well.
Do we arrest too many people and put them in jail for too long a time for lesser crimes, perhaps?
Not that I see, no. Yeah. Back in the early days of my career, I think that we were knee-deep in the war on drugs. I was working for D. Mm-hmm. Joyce Hayes then. Mm-hmm. And what the mindset was of the times was if you're dealing drugs or using drugs, that you're a danger to the community and you should go away. And that's what our laws were then. I think there's been a complete shift in the thinking in almost every prosecutor's office that I've been in contact with across the country. And prosecutors are looking for other ways to handle cases other than to send people to the penitentiary. Mm-hmm. We have numerous diversion programs started under my administration that are very successful. Some of them are being copied nationally. And I think we need to certainly get the violent criminals off the street, no question about that. But a lot of the lesser crimes, the drug possession crimes, the minor property crimes, I think we would serve ourselves better if we started figuring out what are the root causes of that, what is it that makes young people want to do that, and start focusing our energy on our resources on providing solutions for those causes.
Are you saying we incarcerate too many people? I mean, there's an argument to be made that we do because we do it more than any other country in the world.
I agree. I mean, if you look at the national statistics, it's inescapable to conclude that we incarcerate more people than anybody else. It's also inescapable to conclude that we incarcerate African Americans at a higher rate, much higher rate than they are represented in the community. So I think generally, prosecutors and the justice system in general have to take a good, hard look at that, an unflinching look at that, as we go forward in the coming years. However, in St. Louis, I don't believe that people are getting an inordinate amount of prison time or an inappropriate amount of prison time. I don't see that in my jurisdiction, but my jurisdiction is unique unto itself. And I think it's probably folly to compare that nationally, you know, in terms of statistics.
Let me give you what I believe is a public perception about prosecutors. And that is most prosecutors are elected officials. In order to get elected and reelected, they have to show some signs of success. And that would mean scalps on the belt, prosecutions, successful prosecutions. Do you think, because of that, in general terms, prosecutors maybe are overzealous in their prosecutions?
It's hard for me to answer that question. I'm sure there are some prosecutors out there somewhere, you know. I mean, I don't know why I'm picking on Phoenix, but they have that crazy sheriff out there, and I'm sure there's prosecutors.
Not anymore. Joe Arpaio.
He's gone?
He's gone,
okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, it's like saying all radio hosts are X. You know, you can't say that.
Leave us out of it.
and maybe I'm being too literal. I am a lawyer, and we tend to be very literal. But I think I don't know any prosecutors that are doing this work because they want to have scalps on their belt. I think that they are doing this work because they want to serve the public. And to me, it's much more of a job of calling balls and strikes. You get presented with a case, the police make the arrest, and you analyze that case and decide whether or not a prosecution is going to go forward. And what would surprise people is that probably 50% of the time, we would issue cases that the police would bring us under my administration. And that statistic's constant. That goes back before my time. So the police arrest someone, and there's a 50-50 chance that we are going to agree that that case should be prosecuted. That is not, I think that is the reality. That's the fact. And I don't see how that squares up with the mythology of prosecutors just wanting to put everybody in prison so that they can get reelected. I always thought, once I took office, I had a conversation with my sister, Maggie, who's listening. Hi, Maggie. And we talked about, wow, now I'm elected. How am I going to stay elected? And after talking with her, I concluded that I can't possibly even think about getting reelected. I mean, I can't make any decision for any reason other than it's the just thing to do and it's the correct thing to do. Under the laws and the facts, this case should be prosecuted or this case should not be prosecuted. Once you start thinking about how is this going to look politically, you're dead in the water as an elected prosecutor, in my opinion.
There is another public perception, I believe, out there concerning the relationship between prosecutors and police. Mm-hmm. This has come up a lot recently in connection with the numerous police shootings that have taken place here and elsewhere. What's your response to that? I mean, you have to work together. Obviously, you need the police. You need the police to give you the material you need to do your job.
Right. We do work together, but as I just mentioned, you know, half the time the police stay up all night and make an arrest. We don't go forward with the case for whatever reason. There's not enough evidence there. So the idea that we are rubber stamps for the police is pretty ludicrous if you understand how the system works. It's my job to prosecute the police, and I've prosecuted the police who committed crimes consistently throughout my tenure. One of the first cases that I prosecuted as an elected prosecutor was prosecuting a police officer for murder. I just recently filed charges last year against another police officer for murder. I've prosecuted police officers for assault and other crimes consistently. But I also, because I work so closely with them, have a deep abiding respect for the law enforcement and for the police department. And I understand that there are some bad apples in that group, but the vast majority of them are incredibly inspirational public servants, and they deserve our thanks and gratitude. But does that mean that I'm not going to prosecute a police officer who commits a crime? No. I mean, really, Joe Mokwa, who was the chief during part of my tenure, used to call the relationship between our offices as a Catholic marriage, because we could get into an argument, but we could never get divorced. He was the only police department. I was the only state prosecutor. So we had to figure out a way to get along. There's a lot of friction points in between the prosecutors and the police department. We frustrate each other all the time, but we have to figure out the best way to work together for the interests of the public.
This perception has been fed in part, though, I suspect, in recent years in particular, because there has been a seeming reluctance on the part of prosecutors in other parts of the country, given some of the the headline cases that have been so much in the news, a reluctance to prosecute officers.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, I think prosecutors have done themselves a disservice in their poor communication about the decisions that they make and why they make them. And the Chicago instance, where they did not release that videotape for a year and had to be ordered to release it. You know, I don't know. I'm not on the inside there. But that looked like an example of where politics were driving the car instead of what's the right thing to do. And again, you just can't operate that way as an elected prosecutor.
Politics is not an unknown dynamic in Chicago, I understand.
Correct. Right. It's not in any jurisdiction. So.
Sure. Jennifer Joyce is our guest. We have to take a break. We'll do that and come back and continue our conversation, reflecting on her 16 years in the prosecutor's office. We'll talk a little bit also about what lies ahead for Ms. Joyce. We'll do that in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Jennifer Joyce. Jennifer, staying with the subject of the police for just a moment, given what's been going on the last year or two or three, are police too quick to shoot?
Well, that's a tough question. I've seen some cases, and I look at all of them nationally, where it certainly seems that way to me. But I have to say, Don, I am not an expert in police use of force. And in my job as circuit attorney and reviewing police shooting cases, you know, I've brought in experts in that field. And it is a field that you can, you know, have a great deal of knowledge in. So my reluctance in second guessing these officers in other cities that I've seen is, you know, I mean, I am reluctant to do that because I don't know the ins and outs of it. But just as a layperson watching some of these videos, I think that, it would appear that way.
Videos have really changed everything, haven't they?
They have. They have. When I first started being a prosecutor, it was right after Rodney King. And every case that we prosecuted, that theme came up. You know, the Rodney King case was on everybody's mind. Recently, a couple of years ago, I was talking about that videos are turning every case into Rodney King again, and a lot of the young people in the office didn't know who Rodney King was and didn't remember that case, and so that's when I felt really old. But yeah, the videos are, and I'm all in favor of the body cameras, dash cam videos, you know, citizen videos, whatever. The public should understand that they're not a panacea. You know, they're not going to get Steven Spielberg quality, you know, video out of these things. Many times a video can misrepresent what really happened due to camera angles and things like that. But with all those caveats and managing the expectations of the public, it's always better to have video evidence than to not.
But what kind of legal weight do they carry, therefore, given the fact that various angles and what have you can kind of mislead the viewer?
If you can introduce them into evidence, they should carry mm-hmm. tremendous legal weight. I mean, did you get them before the jury, and the jury can decide and hear mm-hmm. from the defense attorney and the prosecutor as to what that video shows, and the jury can watch it themselves back in the jury room as many times as they want and mm-hmm. make their own decision. I've seen videos that are really inconclusive. I've seen videos that are very clear cut. It's all over the map. But the fact is, the more we have, like, for instance, body cameras, I think in cities where they've deployed that, they've noticed better behavior on the part of everybody. Better behavior on the part of the guy who gets pulled over, and better behavior on the part of the police officer who's pulling him over.
We mentioned Chicago a moment or two ago, and I've forgotten exactly what the final number was in Chicago for police. 760 or 716, something like that.
Horrible.
An enormous amount of number. St. Louis, I think, tied the number of homicides, shooting homicides.
Which is kind of a, I hate to say it, I hate to be cynical, but that's kind of a victory for us because we had been going up every mm-hmm. year.
Yeah. And this is a cause célèbre of yours, the
yes.
This police violence. Where are we on that? I mean, you leave the office. Are you feeling better about what's been accomplished in terms of reducing that violence or not?
It's probably premature for me to feel better about it. I think there's some things in place at long last that will really be helpful should they stay. Primarily, I'm thinking about that the judges have finally decided to do a gun docket. And what that is, and we tried to do this 3 years ago, is just kind of an individualized approach to these offenders who are young people who are caught carrying a gun. And, you know, when I was a kid, you know, in eighth grade, freshman year, I smoked cigarettes. Now it can be told. Stupid thing to do. I ended up having to quit when I was 30. It was really difficult for me. Wish I hadn't have done that, but I didn't kill anybody. Nowadays, these young kids are carrying guns, you know, stupid thing to do. But that is not as a forgiving vice as cigarette smoking mm-hmm. is. And so we need to find a way to get to these kids and give them some structure and some accountability on an individual basis to get them to take a different path. This is what we proposed 3 years ago with the judges. They did not want to do it then. Fortunately, they changed their mind, and they're doing something very, very similar to what we proposed to them. And it's working. In the cases that we've seen go through, 90% have not recidivated, which is pretty remarkable considering what we normally see. So I think that if it's left to go forward, will have a big impact. We also have a gun diversion program, which is basically the first in the country. The Department of Justice has funded it. We're kind of a laboratory for the rest of the country on that, where we actually get rid of the conviction if somebody completes a pretty rigorous program. And then I think you need to have experienced prosecutors who, once somebody has decided that they're going to shoot people and rob people and commit violent crimes in the city, once a young person has made that step, then they really need to be, the public needs to be protected from them. And that takes experienced prosecutors who know what they're doing. And we do have some of those in the office now, and my hope is that they will continue.
What about the, I want to go back to the gun issue in just a moment, but you mentioned the office. What about staffing now? I get the impression with regard to the Reggie Clemens case, for instance,
right,
that you don't have enough people to do the job.
Well, not to do the job, to do that case. Uh-huh. Okay, what people don't realize is what a behemoth the yeah. Chain of Rocks case is.
Yeah.
It's massive in every possible way. Okay, it was prosecuted before I came to the circuit attorney's office and before pretty much everybody in the office came to the circuit attorney's office. The prosecutor, Nils Moss, is now deceased. So that where there's a definite disconnect between the office and that case as it had been prosecuted. It has been for the past, I want to say, 17 years through the appellate stages. The attorney general's office has handled that. That's a black box for my office. We weren't involved with all those appellate different hearings, countless, you know, there were four defendants, so tons and tons of evidentiary hearings, which we would need to get up to speed on. And when the case was remanded back to us, I put four seasoned prosecutors on that case, and I have five total. One was pretty new. And we basically wanted to get that case ready to try in May. Mr. Clemens had decided he wanted to exert his speedy trial, right? And we were wanting to go. This family has suffered inordinately over
the
years.
The Carey sisters, by
right.
the way, who were thrown off the Chain of Rocks Bridge.
Over 25 years
yeah,
ago.
Right.
Okay, so this poor mother of these girls has heard in all of these hearings. She goes to all of them. She's heard probably 100 times how her daughters were gang raped and murdered. I want this case to be over with as quickly as possible. Well, there are a number of delays, which the defendant asked for. He switched his legal counsel. He brought in additional legal counsel. He asked for delays, which is fine, and that's what he's entitled to do. But as we got past the August election for circuit attorney, I started losing people on this case. And projecting out, we're going to lose more people who are assigned to this case. And so there is no way that we can get up to speed again with a whole new, brand new group of people.
What about the Attorney General's office getting up to speed? Aren't
well,
they starting from square one?
No, not at all. They are the experts in this case because they handled it for 17 years.
Okay.
Sue Barisi is the prosecutor on this case, and she has her PhD in this. This is her life's work, is this case. She's the expert. She knows everything about it. And so what we did is make her the lead counsel instead of the circuit attorney's office because of the turnover and the resources issue. And I spoke with Kim Gardner about this, and she agreed wholeheartedly and agreed with the idea that we would ask that this would be that we would be allowed to leave and that the attorney generals would take this case because she has things that she wants to do, and she could not see how she would get those resources.
Right. Let's go back to the gun issue because of a caller who's been waiting for a bit to get into the discussion. That's Jerry in O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Jennifer Joyce.
Good afternoon and Happy New Year to all.
Likewise.
I just have a very simple question. What do you think the effect of the new law that allows essentially any person over the age of 18 to carry either openly or concealed an armed weapon in Missouri?
Well, I think it's a terrible law. I think it's probably one of the worst laws I've ever seen in my life. And I can't imagine that it would have any positive effect anywhere in the state. You know, I don't hang out in Jefferson City that much, but I'm friends with a lot of people in the legislature, and I'm told that this was passed because there were a number of folks running for attorney general in the Republican caucus, and that they all wanted to look as tough as possible on you know, anti-gun legislation, and they made this rule, this law that I can't find a single person who agrees that this is a good idea.
Even the people who sponsored or voted for it?
I think that they were doing that for political purposes. That's what I'm told. That's my opinion anyway. And I've talked to police. I've talked to gun shop owners. I've talked to gun enthusiasts, people that own tons of guns. I haven't found a single person who thinks it's a good idea. It's a ludicrous idea. It's a solution in search of a problem. It's just going to make everything worse.
Well, I guess as the way it's framed in the public discourse is that I think people have a fear that they are most likely to be harmed by someone else in the commission of, say, an armed robbery. And
right.
Yet if a person who is there, a good guy with a gun, is going to prevent that. But in my estimation, what I look at, which is not, of course, all-encompassing, is that a lot of disputes dissolve into violence, and the fact that a gun is readily available is going to make it even more lethal in any kind of a dispute, whether it's a minor traffic accident or a domestic dispute.
I agree, and I want to make clear, I'm not talking about concealed weapons generally. I've made peace with that. My husband and I are gun owners. I have my CCW endorsement. I'm troubled by the fact that we no longer have any screening or qualifications whatsoever for people to carry concealed weapons. You know, to operate a motor vehicle, you have to meet some minimum levels and you have to take your driver's tests and things like that because a motor vehicle is deadly. Why don't we have that same thing for guns? I don't know. And that's the thing that nobody knows what the benefit of that is, the permitless carry.
It's a political benefit. Thank
Correct.
You know, it's just hard to fathom that people can make the argument, and I'll get in trouble for saying this, that if a shooter comes into a movie theater and starts blasting away at people, and the people in the theater take out their guns and start shooting at this person, that's a good thing.
I think we saw something similar to that back in the day when the gunman was in the St. Louis County Courthouse.
Oh, Bomerick.
Yes,
Bomerick case,
and there were a lot of police officers there for their court cases, and there wasn't a requirement that the police check their guns, and a lot of the police officers were in plain clothes, and everybody had their gun, and it was hard to tell who was the good guy or the bad guy, and it was pandemonium. Now, if you go to the St. Louis County Courthouse, you know, bring along a book because you're going to wait in a very long metal detector line, and they have completely revamped because of a situation like that.
Yeah. We have an email here from Rachel. It says, if parts of the relationship between police and prosecutor are supposed to be friction, why did some of your initiatives around gun violence and homicide focus on getting more cases issued?
Well, our process, our role in the criminal justice system is to provide a check and balance for the actions of the police. But certainly if the police make an arrest of someone that has committed a murder and we review that case and we agree that it's legally and factually sufficient, then we do want to charge that case. So the more cases that we're able to analyze quickly and close up, the better in terms of getting shooters off the street. That doesn't change our role as being a check and balance for the police.
What influence did Ferguson have on your job?
Ferguson was really, if I had to point to one singular event that will always stand out in my mind, it would be the Ferguson. Even though it didn't directly involve me, it involved Bob McCullough, who's my colleague and in the next jurisdiction over. And honestly, I had been, when you pick a jury in the city of St. Louis, you get to hear a focus group talking about attitudes about police. And so for my whole career as a prosecutor, I've heard people from the city of St. Louis talking about their concerns. And so when Ferguson erupted in St. Louis County, I was initially quite surprised that it didn't happen in the city of St. Louis because we have a lot of the same frustrations in our citizenry as the people in Ferguson did. I think Ferguson was a turning point. It was a sea change for law enforcement across the country. Prosecutors and police together. And some of the things that it's changed is I think that prosecutors now really have to focus on how to be as open as possible and as good a communicators as possible in the decisions that they make. The grand jury decision in St. Louis County to not indict Darren Wilson, there's a legal basis for that. And whether you agree with the decision or not, there's a legal basis for it. I'm not saying that Bob did a poor job. I think Bob tried to explain that, but by the time he was talking to people about it, people had already made up their minds and they didn't want to hear more about it. What I urge prosecutors around the country to do, and I've been invited to speak probably in 30, 40 different meetings and different prosecutors around the country, is we need to find a time where there's not a crisis going on and bring people in and talk to them and help them understand the system and what we do and what's in our heart and why we do what we do. You can't wait until there's a crisis to start talking to the public. You need to do it early on.
Would you have done things differently here in the city? Had you been involved?
I think I would probably have had a different style in my communications. But you know, in my jurisdiction, I'm I think over 50% African American population, a lot of poverty, a lot of all kinds of crime, and you know, it's just a different jurisdiction. St. Louis County is much more affluent, 70% Caucasian, and so from the get-go, I knew I had to talk to people and go out to neighborhood meetings all over the city, and that there was a lot of people that were generally going to be skeptical of me just because of who I was. And so we kind of had, I think, a little bit more of a basis of support in the community because we had invested in that over the years. I've talked to Bob about it, and the one thing I heard him say, and he's a very skilled prosecutor and a very confident guy, as I'm sure you know, mm-hmm. but he says he wishes he would have spent more time building relationships in the community. And I think that we had done that. And then I also had a lot of communications channels already set up. We had our Facebook page. We had our Twitter page. We had a very robust website. And we had ways, a listserv and ways to communicate with people. So I probably would have tapped into those resources, my communications ability and my contacts in the neighborhoods, and communicated differently than Bob did.
You in a sense were impacted by that in a different way because there were some demonstrations mm-hmm. in the entire area, some of which were very literally very close to your home.
Yes.
That impacted you. We've talked about this before, but that was disquieting to you, wasn't it?
It was disquieting. I have no problem with people coming and protesting outside the courthouse. What I'd really like is for them to come in and talk to me. But, you know, some people do come in and talk, and I'm always grateful for that. Some people really are just more interested in making the public statement out in front of the courthouse, and that's fine, too. That goes with the territory. You know, you're going to be criticized in this job. But they did come to my home once fairly late at night, 9:30 at night, and That was very disturbing for me and my husband and the people in my very quiet residential neighborhood. I mean, all the kids on my block got to learn a whole new vocabulary that evening, and it was really pandemonium outside. And I thought that was regrettable on their part. I really did.
Did that have any impact on your decision to retire?
No, I had made my decision to retire before then. I made my decision to retire at the end of this term, probably 5 years prior.
Really? You know, this is my personal opinion, but I fully expected you to run for mayor. And I thought, with all of your tweeting and all of your communication with the public, and I understand what you've been saying and mm-hmm. why you're saying it, but I said, Jennifer Joyce is up to something. I think she wants to run for mayor. Of course I was wrong, as I often am, but mm-hmm. but was I?
No. You know, the hard part about running for mayor is that if you get elected, you have to be the mayor. Mm-hmm. And that is a really, really difficult job in this city. The city has some really intractable problems. I think we got some good people running. I'm just interested in taking a break from that right now, and that's not something that I ever entertained.
Would you consider coming back into public life, the public realm, at some point after you've gotten this wanderlust out of your system?
Well, I guess the most conservative thing to say would be to never say never. But right now I'm really focused on getting through the snow and getting down south where we're going. So,
all right. Well, I can't blame you for that. Jennifer Joyce is our guest. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Again, if you'd like to come in, 382-8255 is the number. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to Jennifer. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Jennifer Joyce, who as of just a couple of days ago is no longer the circuit attorney of the city of St. Louis, a job she held since the year 2000, 16 years, the only mm-hmm. circuit attorney this century. That's
the longest serving ever circuit attorney. I beat George Peach by 5 months or so.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, now it's off to river. Jennifer, I'd like to talk a little bit about voter fraud. It's another thing that you've been involved with, and I guess now the ball has been passed to the the feds with regard to what can you tell us? I understand you have new information, but you can't tell us much about it. What can you tell us about what's going on?
Well, I can recap the developments. We were contacted by Joan Berger, who was then head of the election board, to come and review some complaints that had been made by people supporting Bruce Franks and his race for state representative. And we looked into that. It was always my opinion that this should be a matter that the federal authorities should look at because it was a federal election as well.
Sure.
During our investigation, I'll say initially the federal authorities were not interested, but they stayed in touch with us. They said, keep us posted. And that's not unusual. You know, they handle a different type of case than we do. We were able to develop information in our investigation that made the case attractive to the federal authorities in terms of prosecution and investigation on their part. So I was pleased to be able to give that case to them. I think that they need to be looking at this case. I do have a concern in general about the election process in St. Louis, though. And I hate to say it because I'm a Democrat and this, you know, plays into what many people in the Republican Party accuse Democrats of is, you know, the voter irregularities. But to me, it seems like no one is in charge of policing what's going on at the Board of Elections. You know, there's no one who's in charge of reviewing those things. That's way beyond what the circuit attorney's office would have the resources and the authority to do. The Secretary of State seems to not be really looking very closely at it. The federal authorities aren't looking very closely at it. And so we have Doug Moore in the Post-Dispatch and his colleagues doing a series of articles. Well, I think that's good for the Post-Dispatch, but I don't think it's good for the community that the media are the ones charged with policing the election board.
There's new information that you have, and I understand your reluctance to get into it while it's at the station it is at the present time. But does this involve, number one, does it involve only the 78th Legislative District, the Penny Hubbard and Bruce Franks race, and does it involve only absentee ballots?
Well, I'm sorry. You had it right the first time. It's not something that I can talk about. But I can also say that, you know, there's been perennially in my career issues at the Board of Election. I mean, it's not uncommon. I was recalling right after I took office initially in 2001, we had a big brouhaha blow up with the Board of Elections. And it's happened repeatedly throughout my career. And this one is maybe a little bigger, but, you know, it's pretty much along the same lines. And I think we're going to keep coming back to this if we don't, as a region, figure out who's going to be in charge of making sure things are running right at the Board of Elections.
Donald Trump has actually cited St. Louis during the course of the campaign as saying that we're right up there among the worst offenders in the voter fraud arena. Would you agree with that?
You know, it's strange. That's the one thing that Donald Trump has said that I disagree with. That's a joke. Donald Trump is an interesting person. And, I mean, he also said that Ferguson was one of the most dangerous cities in the world. So, I mean,
more dangerous than Baghdad, I think.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, I think he is not constrained by any facts or reality when he utters things. And so I'm trying to find, if anybody knows, please tweet me, a way to watch the national and international news but not read stories about Trump. I don't know if there's a way. A Trump-free news aggregator is what I'm looking for because he's just a ridiculous man. That's all I can say.
You're not leaving the country in your RV, are you?
No.
After this election?
No, I'm actually going to be in Texas at first, so I'm going to keep my views about Trump to myself.
Voter ID, that's the reality now in the state of Missouri, given your feelings about voter irregularities. You for it?
I'm not in favor of it to the extent that it would disenfranchise anybody, but I think it's, you know, it's important to make sure that people who are voting, you know, are registered and have a right to vote there. I mean, the legislative process on this, I know, was sausage making, but when it comes down to it, we need to be comfortable that people who are voting in an election in the city are authorized to do so. And I don't know that it is too much to ask to have some kind of verification of that.
And yet the opponents of voter photo ID say that it will disenfranchise people.
I know they do, yes. And I certainly wouldn't want that. So I'm not sure that that's true. We'll have to see.
Let's go back to the phones. We have a number of callers who are now wanting to take part. So let's start with Harvey calling from Chesterfield. Harvey, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I love the idea of a Trump-free news aggregator. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, really. My question is, what effect would you see the legalization of recreational marijuana having on the city, the crime rate, just in general? Any comments you'd be able to make?
Yeah, I know I'm in the minority on this in the city, but after reviewing what the experience that they've had in Denver, I think it would probably have a negative effect. I'm not opposed to medical marijuana if the FDA, you know, vets it and treats it like any other kind of drug. But just plain old legalized marijuana, I'm concerned about children getting it. I'm concerned about all the, you know, attractive candy-like edibles. I'm concerned about people driving and increased motor vehicle accidents. And I'm concerned about young people in high school getting addicted to it. And it's a myth that marijuana is not addictive. It certainly is, and we've seen that. So I am not in favor of full-out legalization of marijuana. And the other thing, and maybe this is just me being suspicious, but there is so much money, billions and billions and billions of dollars behind this. This is like big tobacco to the 10th power. And anytime there's that much money behind an initiative, you know, I think they like to hold themselves out as some nice hippie guy who's wants marijuana legalized. It's big money behind it. I think we need to pay careful attention to that and be careful.
Big money also generates big taxes, and that's an issue that a city like St. Louis and many others
would like to
take part in that.
Yeah, and I think that's a compelling argument for it, but I think that we really need to balance that against what we've, you know, look hard. Now a lot of states have that legalized. I think there's a real good laboratory right now to look hard at those states and see what's happening and decide if we want that in Missouri.
More taxes would mean more money for the city prosecutor's office.
Correct. But I still wouldn't say that trumps all the other ills. Did I say Trump?
There's that name again. Where's our Trump-free aggregate going here? With regard to marijuana, Dan wants to pick up on the medical marijuana point. Let's bring him in. He's calling from Columbia. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the air.
Thank you. There's a great deal of evidence that traffic fatalities are down in medical marijuana states, if you look at the science on this. But, Ms. Joyce, you joined in a lawsuit to stop Missouri voters from even having an opportunity to vote on what people in 29 other states, including Illinois, have, which is legal access to marijuana if a doctor approves of it. I just cannot understand why you would go to that length of actually suing Jason Kander to stop Missouri voters from even having a chance to address that issue.
Well, that's correct. I did, and I would do it again in a heartbeat, given the same circumstances. I thought that ballot language was very not representative of what the initiative was. And as I said before, I think it's premature to have legalized marijuana right now. It has not been tested by the FDA. And ultimately, it didn't make any difference because the people collecting signatures failed to get sufficient signatures for it to be on the ballot. But yeah, absolutely, I did that, as did many other prosecutors, and would do it again.
We're operating now under a revised criminal code.
Yes.
Good thing?
I think so. The criminal code hadn't been revised since the early 70s, and it took a tremendous amount of work on the part of many, many people, many prosecutors, public defenders, judges, and we have that new criminal code. Fortunately, we were able to do training before I left office. We've spent the past several months doing training with the attorneys in our office, and we've also been asked to train some of the public defenders and the judges on the criminal code. So I'm happy to say that I've kind of handed something off to Kim Gardner here, where we're all ready to go on the new criminal code in the circuit attorney's office. I know she voted against it, but now she's going to, you know, obviously be living with it as the prosecutor.
What has been your relationship with the public defenders? As you know, my son was with the city public defender's office.
Well, then I should ask you.
Well, Maybe not. Maybe not. But what is the relationship? You know, it's an adversarial relationship from the get-go. It has to be. But your friend and colleague Bob McCullough is not a great fan of public defenders and complains about their complaining about being overworked.
Well, let me tell you this right off the bat is that, you know, Bob McCullough and I are both elected prosecutors, but we are very different in many ways. I like and respect him. I believe he likes and respects me, but we have completely different styles and likes and dislikes. I think that it's hard to generalize the relationship with the public defenders. I recently hired three former public defenders, and they're some of the best attorneys in the office.
And Kim Gardner has brought two over from what I see in the paper this morning.
Yes, I saw that. And that's interesting because those are public defenders who only recently just stepped down like a matter of weeks ago. So that's going to result in a lot of conflict of interest cases because when you hire someone from the public defender's office, any of the cases that they touch, you can no longer prosecute. And one of the women that they hired was a manager. So I don't know. I'm sure they've thought all that through. But that was the first thing that I thought of was, wow, that's a big conflict situation. But I'm sure they've thought it through. They're both great lawyers. I think they're smart hires. Hiring public defenders gives you a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And I've done that after they've been out of the public defender's office for a while. But there's no question that you got a lot of younger lawyers, and sometimes they get very enthusiastic on both sides, and I think that sometimes people are a little bit more combative than they need to be. But
are public defenders overworked and underpaid?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. Not more so than prosecutors. In my circuit, again, I have to qualify that because I'm not the prosecutor in every circuit in Missouri. But I do see effective legal representation on the part of the public defenders. They're fine attorneys. I don't see any signs that they are lacking resources. And they certainly don't act as if they're lacking resources in the vociferous litigation that they engage in.
Yeah. Well, a call and an email here that I want to get in before our time is up. Number one is an email from Kara Spencer, the alderwoman from the 20th Ward, tweets, "Great to hear Jennifer Joyce on St. Louis on the Air. Joyce's service to our city as circuit attorney is an inspiration to me and to many others."
Oh, I love Kara Spencer. She is my favorite alderman, one of my very favorites. She is such a mover and a shaker and smart lady. She's fun to watch.
A mutual admiration society.
Yes.
Going here.
Girl power.
More of it coming. Let's bring in Curtis calling from St. Louis. Curtis, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Don, and good afternoon, Jennifer. I'm so glad you accepted my call, Don, because going back many, many, many years when Jennifer first came on, she's the type of prosecutor that would come up into Walnut Park and walk with us when we were holding our anti-drug, anti-gang drug marches with caring communities. And I have enjoyed, as a public official, as an elected official, she is one of the few that I hold in high esteem for the work that she does and the caliber of work that she does, the ethics, the moral ethics, the professional ethics, everything about you, Jennifer, is something that I will always cherish in my heart. I wish you and your husband well on your endeavors. I hope to do that in about 5 years myself, just buy an RV and get out on the road. But
are you on Facebook?
Yes, I will find you then because I
lawyers on the lamb.
I will do it, but Jennifer, just bless you. And Don, thank you for squeezing this call in, because this young lady right here is somebody that all St. Louisans should respect. We don't always agree on everything, but I do respect her in every sense of the word.
Thank you, Curtis.
Curtis, thank you so much for the call. Well, that's a nice way to end it, isn't it?
I know. I hope my mother-in-law is listening.
Was it Maggie? Maggie, did you say?
Maggie's listening.
It's a family affair. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on 16 years in the job, the longest ever in that position, and now it's off to bigger and better things.
Yes. Thank you so much, Don.
We'll be following you on Twitter, I'm sure. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.